The U.S. Navy blends traditional and modern warfare tactics to one day battle China in the seas. This is Brief Before Impact. Welcome, everyone. I am Matt Parker. Today's episode, we're going to be discussing how the U.S. Navy is modernizing its force as it specifically focuses on the threat of China. We're going to discuss its modernization efforts in the traditional Navy, what we call the ships, submarines, etc. Second, we're going to talk about Navy SEALs fulfilling that special operations mission for the Navy and how they are adjusting their tactics and technology after 20 years of fighting counterterrorism in the Middle East and now focusing on that near peer competitor in the South China Sea, especially. And lastly, talk about highlight some technologies that have been developed and the Navy has incorporated, kind of leaning into the future conflicts. Before we jump into it, let me just take a quick ad break and then we will get to work. All right, welcome back, everyone. Let's start with how the Navy has been modernizing and updating its forces to prepare for this eventual conflict with China. Admiral William Lesher, he told the House Armed Services Committee that China clearly remains the pacing threat for the U.S. military. Quote, "The U.S. Navy brings a strong view to the decade of concern is 2020. And in some respects, that's not a universal view in the department, but we consistently believe and have thought that that's the decade that we will see a peak risk and that we're going to be ready for," end quote. Admiral Lesher highlighting the threat that is growing and continues to grow facing China. And this is according to Defense News. In its budget request for the fiscal year, the Navy asked to decommission 15 ships. That's including 7 cruisers. Now, this drew kind of an ire from many of the House Armed Services Committee members who argued that if the Navy was going to fight China this decade, it needed a larger fleet this decade, rather than divesting cruisers today and eventually reinvesting that money into unmanned surface combatants or other technologies still under development. But Admiral Lesher contended that there's no contradiction in the Navy's fiscal 2022 budget and its expectation that China is most likely to attack Taiwan this decade. He's referring to the decade between 2020 and 2030, just to be clear. Now, Admiral Lesher had said that the Navy went through a number of analytic efforts to determine the size and the composition of the force it would need to defeat China. Critical is the Navy's ability to do certain things. Let me list these out. 1, send long-range fires downrange. Fires, if you're not familiar, like think about a massive artillery shell, for example, or even a missile launch from a ship. That's what they're referring to in fires. 2, maneuver in the adversary's weapons engagement zone. If you listen to last episode when I talk about the Marine Corps wanting to operate with inside the weapons engagement zone of China, this is an area that China actively is operating in and quote unquote kind of owns from a military defense perspective. This is what the Navy intends to do as well. 3, operate ships without needing frequent resupply in a contested logistics environment. 4, defend against incoming missiles through hard kill and soft kill defenses. These are the things that the Navy is prioritizing it would need to do that are critical to its ability to defeat China in war. Now, something if you've been listening to this series of our military branches in how they're modernizing their efforts after all these decades of fighting counterterrorism, I obviously come back to Navy to China, and that's the focus, that's the threat. And these aren't Matt Parker's views. These are a reflection of what the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, sees. I haven't highlighted yet in great detail how China is updating its military capacity, and in this instance, specifically the Navy, in order to fight what they view as conflict as well. So let me quickly do this and share with you kind of what the China naval modernization, how its ongoing effort and what it's trying to do in order to prepare for the United States with ultimately that goal that we've talked about in so many episodes before of bringing Taiwan back into the fold, so to speak. So according to a report from the Congressional Research Service highlighting China's military modernization effort, it included its naval modernization effort, and it's assessed as being aimed at developing capabilities for addressing the situation with Taiwan militarily if need be. Let me list off the four things it's focusing on, the Chinese naval modernization. One, for achieving a greater degree of control or domination over China's near seas region, particularly the South China Sea. Two, for enforcing China's view that it has the right to regulate foreign military activities in its 200-mile maritime exclusive economic zone. This zone is also known as the EEZ. Right? Third, for defending China's commercial sea lines of communication, particularly those linking China to the Persian Gulf. And finally, for displacing U.S. influence in the Western Pacific, and for asserting China's status as the leading regional power and a major world power. This is what China intends to do by modernizing its navy and achieving its goals in the region and, for that matter, in the world. Now, as the China's navy goes through the same type of modernization, it's consistent with these goals. Observers believe that China wants its navy to be capable of acting as a part of Chinese anti-access area denial. This is like what also called A2AD force. This force, let me describe it for you. It is a force that can deter U.S. intervention in a conflict in China's near seas region over Taiwan or some other issue, or failing that, delay the arrival or reduce the effectiveness of intervening U.S. forces. So if you think and consider about this, China wants to have the ability to at least deter U.S. intervention in the South China Sea, and if we can't at least deter it, slow it down and reduce the effectiveness of the U.S. Navy if the U.S. Navy were to respond to some conflict in that region. Now, additional missions for China's Navy include conducting maritime security, that would include anti-piracy operations, evacuating Chinese nationals from foreign countries when necessary, and conducting humanitarian assistance disaster response operations. With that outline of the Chinese modernization efforts, the U.S. Navy in recent years has taken a number of actions to counter China's naval modernization efforts. Among other things, the U.S. Navy has shifted a greater percentage of its fleet to the Pacific, assigned its most capable new ships and aircraft and its best personnel to the Pacific, maintained or increased general presence operations, training and developmental exercises, and engagement and cooperation with allied and other navies in the Indo-Pacific. Additionally, it's increased the planned future size of the Navy. It's initiated, increased, or accelerated numerous programs for developing new military technologies and acquiring new ships, aircraft, unmanned vehicles, and weapons. It's begun development of new operational concepts for countering Chinese maritime A2AD forces, and signaled that the Navy in coming years will shift to a more distributed fleet architecture that will feature a smaller portion of larger ships, a larger portion of smaller ships, and a substantially greater use of unmanned vehicles. The issue for Congress is whether the U.S. Navy is responding appropriately to China's naval modernization effort. If you listen to my last episode when I was talking about the Marine Corps, I made a comment, and I want to reiterate it here about the challenge between the different branches of the Department of Defense and conveying their mission to an elected body of government officials, you know, Congress. Congress writes the checks for anything the Department of Defense wants. It allocates monies because the Congress alone has the power to tax the people. When it takes that money, the tax money, it then distributes it to different programs. One of our bigger expenses is the Department of Defense and our national security. So you have, in this case, with the U.S. Navy, so you've got an admiral, four-star admiral with 30-plus years of experience in the military, tremendous amount of institutional knowledge. And in his or her opinion, they will, this person will line out what they believe the focus should be for the U.S. Navy in the short to near term, 3, 5, 10 years, etc. And now that person with all this military knowledge has to go to convey to a body of elected officials, civilians of all sorts of backgrounds, many of them non-military backgrounds, on the importance of allocating certain amount of dollars to this modernization effort. So there are always multiple levers to pull and to push in the instance of getting a budget passed for any type of military branch. Yes, if you're of the same opinion and belief system that I am, then you want a American military that has all the capabilities, its personnel to have all the adequate training to deter and defeat any enemies that challenge our livelihoods, our way of life, or certainly our freedoms. However, that same military has to answer to, or has to answer to a elected body of officials who are responsible to answer to us. That's a challenge, despite how great the idea is by that military commander. So, with that being said, this is what the Navy is attempting to do in order to modernize its force, in order to fight China eventually in some type of maritime conflict, most likely in and around the South China Sea. Let's pivot to the special operations apparatus of the U.S. Navy. These are kind of brothers in arms with myself, the Navy SEALs. I'm sure you are familiar with the Navy SEALs based upon the multiple books and movies that are available about this incredible group of warriors. Let me give you an outline of what the Navy SEALs have been doing to prepare for any type of conflict that they might participate in against China. Because remember now, since 9/11, the Navy SEALs, just like Army Special Forces, Army Rangers, a number of Tier 1 units like Delta Force and SEAL Team 6, have all been operating in throughout the Middle East combating terrorism, which has been and will continue to be a threat to our citizens and our country. However, while that threat has dwindled in recent years and the rise of China has propelled the military to focus its efforts elsewhere, you now have a unit like the Navy SEALs with an incredible amount of decades of experience, of wartime experience, now having to take that experience and transition it away from the mountains of Afghanistan, the deserts of Iraq, to kind of a maritime region such as like the South China Sea, or even the jungles of these islands, or the conditions of the South Pacific. So, for the Navy SEALs, this is according to National Interest, the magazine 1945, Navy SEALs and Special Warfare Combatant Craft Crewmen Operators have been working with the U.S. Navy Forces in a certification exercise. This is of the USS Eisenhower Strike Group. Now, during this exercise, the Navy Special Operators were the eyes and ears of the Carrier Strike Group, assisting with over-the-horizon targeting, strategic reconnaissance, and close air support. Let me just jump in real quickly. When you consider like a traditional naval combat scenario, if you ever watch any kind of documentary over World War II and the battles in the Pacific, these were massive carrier strike groups with submarines and cruisers and destroyers. This is surface warfare. How does a special operations unit like the Navy SEALs, who have primarily been a land warfare unit, how do they pivot and kind of rejoin their traditional brothers on naval ships? This is how special operators like the SEALs will be able to assist any type of conflict against China. It's specifically by offering that strategic reconnaissance and close air support, meaning they are ahead of the large warships in much smaller vessels or even on remote islands, providing targeting for those large vessels, whether it's the planes that are launching from those carriers or the missiles being fired from those different ships. So the Navy SEALs and these special boat teams are looking to be an asset, both in gray zone competition and in a potential conflict. So when it comes to the underwater domain, the SEAL teams have a great asset, and this is the what they call the SEAL delivery vehicle. These are mini submarines. They're very hard to detect, and they enable SEAL operators to approach enemy harbors and coast clandestinely to attack enemy vessels, insert and extract a small team to conduct reconnaissance or carry out ambushes or raids. These SDVs, these delivery vehicles, can be launched from regular submarines, surface vehicles, and even helicopters. Now, Navy Special Warfare is equally capable in the lateral domain. So special boat teams operate a fleet of small special operations surface craft that can stealthily maneuver close to enemy shores, inserting or extracting special operations teams, conducting that strategic reconnaissance or direct action raids and ambushes. Now, naval special warfare must, quote, set the conditions to undermine adversary confidence and provide civilian leaders with diplomatic leverage and flexible response options in a crisis or a conflict. So this is how Navy SEAL operators are going to be able to work as a complement to those large amphibious vessels that the traditional Navy is operating with. For example, China has 18 out of the 25 biggest megacities. These are more than 10 million people. Those are the biggest, 18 of the biggest, 25 biggest megacities in the world. Now, several of which are near coast or close to waterways, and those megacities are home to critical telecommunication nodes that could be targets for Navy special operators. Now, even through this, Russia's coast would also be ideal environments for naval special operations. This is how the U.S. Navy SEALs are going to be continue to be such a key force in the fight against China if it were to take place in the in this next decade. Now, according to National Interest, the preparations appear, by the preparations of the Navy SEALs, appear to be a part of a strategic effort to respond to a newer threat environment, which will increasingly require the broader deployment of unmanned systems for undersea, surface, and land warfare operations. For example, the proliferation of unmanned surface vehicles, for instance, may require small or manned small boat missions to operate in a role of kind of command and control, thereby exposing small groups of sailors to the rigors and the dangers of rough seas. Now, by extension, the Navy's current distributed maritime operation strategy, it calls for more disaggregated operations as a way to leverage the benefits afforded by long-range sensors and advanced networking systems for mission coordination. Now, this, of course, may mean that small groups of forces might need to operate at greater distance from host ships or larger mechanized land formations. The point this report is making is that any type of conflict that emerges in the South China Sea, it might require a different type of effort by combining the abilities of special operators like the Navy SEALs and the developing technologies, whether it's unmanned surface vehicles or even just our traditional large surface warfare crafts, in order to operate in coordination, kind of combining all the different skill sets of these different units together in order to defeat China. Again, the report writes that this amounts to a growing need for the military to possess extraction capabilities wherein ropes and ladders can be dropped into the ocean or small groups of Marines and soldiers descend into hostile areas. Enabled by improved and hardened networking systems, small units on land and sea will likely forward operate at greater distances and in more austere environments. Improved networking and dispersed operations also allow for improved multi-domain operations, wherein an Air Force helicopter could more quickly be alerted of a need to extract or insert ground or sea forces in particular combat circumstances. Now, major power war by no means precludes the need for small unit combat operations, but may in fact require more of them. So smaller units are more difficult for enemies to detect and can be effective for clandestine reconnaissance missions or rescue operations, even targeted attack missions. So should small, lethal, and well-networked attack forces operate in more dispersed fashion, it might certainly limit vulnerability to the enemy attack. I'll drive home this point. The Pentagon currently, and has been for years, been wargaming scenarios of what it would be like if China were to invade Taiwan or threaten one of its America's allies in the region. What would it be like if these fake man-made islands that Chinese continue to build out and then put military bases or airstrips on top of, as what would happen if those islands were to continue to push further and further, increasing the radius of Chinese reach? And it seems, based upon the analysis that I've read, that the Navy is ongoing, it has ongoing efforts to complement its traditional capabilities and with the decades of counterterrorism experience, creating kind of a holistic approach to defeating China in the South China Sea. So let's lastly pivot to what modern technology the U.S. Navy is incorporating into its efforts in this eventual conflict with China. Now, according to Forbes magazine, the Navy is working to bring new levels of autonomy to unmanned systems through artificial intelligence. As one of the seven patterns of artificial intelligence, AI, autonomous systems can provide tremendous value. Unmanned aerial vehicles, unmanned surface vehicles, unmanned undersea vessels are all potentially use cases for AI applications. In addition to enabling functions like self-navigation, AI can assist unmanned systems in regulating power and thermals, making them more efficient. For unmanned combat vehicles, AI can be applied to imaging data to improve target identification and acquisition for weapon systems. AI can enhance the functionality of unmanned systems, enabling robots to take the risk, keeping soldiers away from the unnecessary danger. Now, there has certainly been the question of, in the ethical debate, of what role artificial intelligence will play in conflict moving into the future, whether it's killer robots with a single computer chip in their brain that allows them to target and kill enemy combatants without putting our own soldiers, sailors, and Marines at risk, or if it was an unmanned aerial vehicle, unmanned plane that had its orders given to it by just a tap of a computer. And what would happen if that artificial intelligence inside the plane started making decisions outside of the parameters set by it, by the operator? All these things have been tested and debated and continue to be questioned. And I see the necessity of artificial intelligence playing a larger role in combat as just technology develops to removing kind of that human out of that equation and almost putting weapon systems versus weapon systems rather than human beings versus human beings. Obviously, warfare, in my view, will always have the human element. It will be visceral, bloody, and violent. However, there is that desire to limit losses just from a practical and a moral perspective, how it can limit, how a military can limit its losses of personnel, and rather than just allowing its equipment to, say, take that loss, for example. And I think artificial intelligence will continue to grow a larger role, though never, in my opinion, completely removing the human element out of warfare. Another development in technology that I thought was absolutely fascinating was a certain laser system that's been the Navy has been incorporating and certainly testing and demonstrating for audiences. According to Warren Duffy, this is from the Office of Naval Research, the ground-based laser system homed in on a red drone flying by, shooting a high-energy beam invisible to the naked eye. Suddenly, a fiery orange glow flared from the drone. Smoke poured from its engine, and a parachute opened as the aircraft tumbled downward, disabled by the laser beam. Now, this is February. This demonstration marked that for the first time, the U.S. Navy used an all-electric, high-energy laser weapon to defeat a target representing a subsonic cruise missile in flight. This is known as the layered laser defense. LLD. The weapon was designed and built by Lockheed Martin to serve as a multi-domain, multi-platform demonstration system. It can counter unmanned aerial systems and fast attack boats with a high-power laser, and also use its high-resolution telescope to track inbound air threats, support combat identification, and conduct battle damage assessment of engaged targets. So to wrap up this episode, I feel like the rhetoric, or I should say the tone of the last few episodes talking about how each branch is modernizing its forces to deter and to defeat China one day, I almost feel like that conversation's like this is an inevitable conflict to arrive based upon the analysis done. Like this can't be avoided or something like that. And I'll say I think it can be avoided. However, that avoiding such a conflict would require a shift in strategic thinking by geopolitical actors. I think this is kind of the underlying theme that I hope to convey on these episodes. You can pull ideology and even right or wrong out of the equation when you're discussing geopolitics, because ultimately, geopolitics is an engagement of nation states in the system that we have. And those states reflect the individuals that make them up. And individuals, and you've heard me talk about this in previous episodes, while concerned about many things, are deeply concerned about their security, their future, their chances and probability of survival for themselves and their life, their kids, generations after them, the state and the ideology that they represent. And this is how I believe warfare is inevitable in any context for that matter between traditional militaries, whether it's China versus the United States, or untraditional, you know, militants like, you know, the terrorists that we've been fighting for the last 20 years. I say it's inevitable and because this type of fighting has always gone on. Human beings have always felt insecure about their future. And for a whole host of different reasons, they then take that insecurity and launch it into some type of battle against another group. I hope that these episodes talking about our military branches modernizing their forces to defeat whether it's China or the next great threat doesn't make you nervous or scared, but rather encourages you that there is a whole group of our society and its entire focus is to ensure the safety of our people and to assure our national security is ongoing, active, and always present, defending our rights, our freedoms here in the United States. So thanks for tuning in. As always, I hope you are picking up what I'm putting down. I am Matt Parker. This is Brief Before Impact.